Luswig 4, Side 1.
Take the picture, niggas, in! It's really nice up, taking a picture. Take the picture, niggas, in! You ain't got no flash, motherfucker! Niggas taking pictures his ass off. Ain't shit working. Probably ain't got no film in the motherfucker either. This ain't cool in the gang, nigga. Okay. Got them one of them crazy motherfuckers up there. Nigga still wearing a dashiki. I know he crazy. No need to fuck with him at all. What? What happened to the hair on my chest? I never had any hair on my chest. What happened to your pussy? This part, this is the part where the white people come back and see niggas have stolen their seats. You know what's weird to be in Washington, D.C., right? And all the niggas that live here, and they can't vote. This could be a state of niggas. Y'all start voting. This be the first state niggas on. Be D.C., dark country. My God! White people! You motherfuckers came anyway, huh? There's gonna be a lot of niggers there who better go. You never can tell. They might be having a meeting or something. Them motherfuckers sit in bunches too. You know, in case some shit start, they be ready.
To keep the car motor running, don't worry about shit, man. As soon as the show's over, we run right outside into the car. Time's up. Let's go.
Motherfucker though, man, because I came from out the front, man. I saw 8 dead white people still had tickets in their hand. You know, when niggas had just run over there.
Yeah. Move out the way, motherfuckers. Yeah. I ain't seen a nigga in 3 years. Fuck you.
You know how niggas just buffalo their way in somewhere. You know, because white people get their tickets early. You know, 6-7 months in advance. Niggas wait to 2 minutes before showtime. And then show up to argue. What the fuck you mean you ain't got no more tickets? I'm dressed. Some white people get intimidated by that shit too, right? Sure, cut in. It's okay. Go ahead. okay with me, buddy. Well, what did you expect me to do? I mean, there's a whole bunch of them. And it could be related or something, you know? Some white boys don't play that shit, though, right? They'd be like, all right, cut the shit.
Okay? Just cut the fucking crap. Hold on. You fucking ain't right, buddy.
I love to hear white dudes when they be cussing, too, Jack. They got some beautiful words, right? Yeah, come on, peckerhead. Come on, you fucking jerk-off. Son of a bitch, come on.
Niggas be talking about jerk this off.
Yeah, jerk this off. Jerk on this here one time.
Black man will grab them dicks, Jack. And walking down the street, be holding it. Hey.
What's happening, bro? Ain't nothing to it. I'm just hanging on, you know.
Even Andrew Young, he grabbed his dick, right?
Mr. President. May I speak to you a minute, please? Very important. Excuse me, Miss Carter. I'm quite sorry.
Oh, that's all right. Bigger than a peanut.
White dudes don't be grabbing their dicks, though. Y'all don't grab your dick, right? With it.
Nope, never touch it. No, sir. No, never. I pee-pee with it. That's it. I never touch it. Except in a porno movie.
They be getting it in them porno movies, though.
You know, in the corner, in the back.
I can't go to porno movies like I used to, Jack, because people recognize my ass now. Already. Hey, Richard Pryor, huh?
This was the season of the shooting stars. Messages and subpoenas arrived from all over the place. Hans Reichel was another messenger, but a different kettle of fish. He revealed another facet of the same thing to Miller. And little by little, the thing clarified and focused. The angel was the watermark, and God in the ascendant. It proved that a good time might be had even in the higher life. If Edgar gave it to him in words, Reichel handled the message over in wordlessness. The same message. The delicate yet powerful little paintings which Reichel produced on cardboard, wood, or glass spoke to Miller. He understood the language. Which also came from the beyond, from the different roots, planes of life. What he understood was that the man who cannot live on all the root planes simultaneously is a cripple. Reichel somehow hammered the point home. He himself was not a cripple, though handicapped by an overflow of love and delicacy and exacting vision. Every one of his paintings, even if it was only the size of a playing card, was a complete living thing equipped with a living eye, a cosmological eye, which, though Reichel had placed it there with his own hand, seemed to have an even wider range of vision than its creator himself. Reichel was not an easy person to get along with. He was too unsophisticated to make a good neurotic, and constantly hovered between stark madness and gentle sanity. He was full of contradictory passions and endowed with a sort of terrifying seismographic faculty that made him apprehend emotional tremors at a far distance. like an insect sensing an oncoming storm. These storms were rare and far between, but when they broke, the atmosphere was as though impregnated with blood. Henry found him at his gentlest and most delicate best when visiting him in his studio at the Impasse du Rouet. Studio is perhaps too grandiloquent a word for the little den he occupied on the sunny side of the courtyard. Reichel made a wonderful host, even when all he had to offer was a crust of dry bread and a drop of wine. There was a patriarchal quality about his hospitality, reminiscent of the washing of feet and anointing of hair. In his gentle moods, Reichel always moved one to tears. The walls of his room were hung with his paintings, amongst which he lived like an ascetic anchorite. When someone he loved, like Henry, for example, visited him, he would talk at length about his work. He talked about his paintings as a proud mother would about her children, bragging about their precociousness and singularities, now and then pointing out a minor defect, such as a hair lip or an impediment of speech. They were his creatures. He had produced them single-handed out of his heraldic womb. They bore his traits, his scent, his lineament, the lineament of his personality. There was no need for him to explain them to Henry. He recognized them for what they were. Messages from tree, flower, stone, fish, moon, prototypical messages, all of them, staring back at him with their cosmological eyes. Reichel's creations never ceased to enthrall and enchant Henry. In every picture he, Reichel, creates a world, even if it is only the size of a button, he wrote in the first issue of The Booster, a review which we edited and about which I shall have a word to say presently. He thrives in the quicksands, in the astral marshes, in the savannas where the rhododendrons bloom. He is himself a sort of tiger flower, now yellow, now pitch black, and if you squeeze him gently, he exudes a sort of cactus milk, which is most excellent for nursing horned toads, vipers, tarantulas, and Gila monsters. Reichel was a dedicated artist of a sacrificial nature who never painted a picture for gain. He was the rare type of individual who prefers to starve rather than betray what he considers to be his ordained mission. But unlike Miller, whose work and life were indissolubly one, there was a painful discrepancy between Reichel's art and his life. It was almost amounted to a Jekyll Hyde situation in his makeup. He seemed to be possessed by a demonic force, which often made him act in a fearsome manner, especially when drunk. His German atavism, also present in Miller, though much more diluted form, was of no help to him then. All the contradictory streaks of Teutonic mysticism seemed to wage warfare in his breast. He was a great lover of wine, and when he began to drink, he was absolutely unpredictable. Out of a blue sky, as it were, he would fall into violent rages, and then no one was safe. In his incipient madness, he preferably attacked those he loved best. When he ran a monk, as he did every now and then, bloodshed seemed unavoidable. Henry, for whom he normally had the greatest regard, was more exposed than anyone else to Reichel's wrath when the demon got the upper hand. I remember more than one occasion when it nearly came to a fight between the two. Under the influence of wine, Reichel invariably grew jealous of Miller, jealous of anybody and anything. After a bottle or two, his jealousy degenerated into the peculiarly virulent hatred of the have-nots for the haves. Reichel, away from his work, was a have-not. Both Reichel and Miller were extremely fond of Betty Ryan. I have good reason to believe that Reichel was actually in love with her. Knowing that he was hard up, Betty occasionally brought a painting of his to help him. But when he painted a picture that meant everything to him, he would insist that she accept it as a gift. He was full of subtle delicacies in his attitude toward her, and she was touched by his devotion. Betty was an odd character, a rather lovely creature with an aura of purity which found corroboration in her voice, a soft, mysteriously caressing voice, borrowed from the folklore of some forgotten country. Despite her loveliness and enigmatic charm, there was an element about her which I am quite unable to put my finger on and which somehow made her untouchable. We all loved her, and none of us ever dreamed of making love to her. She might as well have been a Madonna. She invited us to dinner in her studio. As a hostess, she was both lavish and adroit. The strange thing about these little celebrations was that all her guests were men. Perhaps she had no woman friends, or if she did, she didn't want them on such occasions. However it may be, Betty was the only woman to grace the table at these gatherings. Enthroned at the head of the table, she gave the key to the conversation, at the same time seeing to it that none of her guests lacked the least thing. The particular dinner I'm thinking of at present was attended by Miller, Reichel, Conrad Mordecai, David Edgar Frankel, and myself. There was also present a young Chinese student, Chu Nian Sen, and was shortly to gain his country, to join his country's army in the fight against the Japanese aggressor. The dinner began well. The mood was of cordiality and conviviality. Betty skillfully avoided any show of favoritism in the way she treated her guest. If she preferred one to another, she concealed the fact. She acted as if it were incumbent upon her to radiate her grace in all directions and as indiscriminately as a star. Miller was sitting at her right, Reichel at her left. Boy, evite des jealousies. I found myself wedged between Edgar and Frankel, like a sort of buffer between two hostile neuroses. Mordekind had to make do with Nian Tian as a neighbor. The erudite astrologer engaged the Chinaman in a discussion of the Li Qi, one of the five sacred books of China. On the whole, we were quite well assorted. Betty directed the canalized the table talk by remote control, as it were, without ever taking the lead herself. She wanted the conversation to be light and effervescent, without incursions into deep or philosophic waters, and up to a point she succeeded. She had her way of playing her guests one against another to maintain a pleasing balance. The coercion was sweet and painless. She was able to make her menfolk feel good while treating them at the same time like marionettes. She pulled a string here and there, and now and then permitted one of the puppets to pull a string for himself. She allowed them to take liberties within reason, without destroying her preconceived pattern, as it were. When Frankel threatened to expatiate on the death theme at greater length than she felt was appropriate, she choked him off by the simple device of getting Edgar started on one of his own pet theories, or by inviting Nian Sen to recite Li Po in Chinese. The Madonna-like creature had all the strings firmly in her hands. She displayed the combined talents of the stage manager, the conjurer, and the strategist. All went well until the dinner was halfway over and the wine began to flow more freely. Reichel had been very quiet up to now, drinking moderately, enjoying his food. Betty, without exactly lionizing him, told him how much she admired and loved his work, and Henry, chiming in, praised his watercolor so extravagantly that Reichel was almost in tears. All the mysticism and sentimentality of his Teutonic soul fused into an outpour of devotion and gratitude to Betty and Henry, his two great friends, the two kindred souls who understood and appreciated the true nature of his inspiration. Getting up from his seat, knife and fork still in hand, he embraced Henry on both cheeks. Then he embraced Betty, then he picked up his glass and emptied it at one gulp. It was particularly heady burgundy, meant to be sipped rather than gulped. Immediately his face flushed, he sat down again, but it was evident that he was no longer interested in his food. He began to talk wildly and incoherently about the inception, gestation, and birth of his paintings. The ideas he wanted to convey were not easily expressible in any language, and since his English was rather inadequate and his French not too good, he employed a sort of homogenized language porridge in which lumps of German were mixed up indissolubly and unintelligibly with English and French. Realizing that he was unable to impart his thoughts and feelings and sensations, he became more and more excited, got up from the table and performed a sort of dumb show with the aid of symbolical gestures, wagging his ears, letting his eyes pop out in fantastic leers, using every legitimate and illegitimate means of communication to make his point clear, pantomimically trying to express the inexpressible. It was a tragic attempt to jump out of his skin, tragic and excruciatingly comical at the same time. Suddenly, Henry began to laugh. The laughter was born in his entrails and broke out with subsultant force. He laughed louder and louder and louder, entering in a landslide. There was nothing else to do. He didn't laugh at him, but for him, laughter was the only antidote. Reichel emerged pale from his antics, not pale from exhaustion, but pale with belligerence. He poured himself a tumbler of brandy and drowned it in a single draught. Sensing the oncoming storm, Betty hastily called upon Mordekind for an interpretation of Reichel's horoscope, which she had recently commissioned him to cast. It was too late for an academic discussion of the chart. The Pluto-Neptune-Uranus trine was erupting in action before our eyes. Henry was still quietly chuckling like the sobs at the end of a weeping fit. Reichel savagely turned on him. It began with a long dithyram of insults. In English, French, and German, Reichel told him what a bastard he was, and then accused him in the homogenized language porridge of his of every conceivable crime, including the heinous sin against the Holy Spirit. Betty tried to intervene, but he shoved her away with an invective, implying that she was actually in league with Henry against him. The situation was fast getting out of hand. The more conciliatory and imploring Betty became, the more violently he attacked her. Go to him, Miller. Is a diablo, a vrai tufel, but you love him, so go with him, and laissez-moi align, always align. And as he said it, he was overcome by a mixture of drunken loneliness and diabolic jealousy, sobbing and raging in turn. Henry had been through all this before, was momentarily at a loss. He had done nothing to incense him. come on, Reichel, take it easy, take it easy, he said, trying to calm him. You've had too much to drink. Don't get all worked up over nothing. But his soothing tone of voice was lost on Reichel. Yes, I am so old. That is why I will tell you the truth. In vino veritas. Du bist ein Schrift, ein traitor. You have all the beautiful words in your mouth. Aber dein Herz ist ein Pfst, a latrine. To say, Imad, digulas. Du mach mich reckon. No honesty, no integrity, all deceit. Tashung, trug. Betty thinks you love her. You pretend to love her, but du bist a narcissist. You never love anybody but yourself. Ein kann lieb. Alles ein kann lieb. He went on like this for some considerable time, his voice always deep and resonant, growing in volume as he worked himself into a frenzy. Nobody made an attempt to stop him. Frankel left the studio, followed by Mordekant. Betty took refuge in the far corner of the studio, where Nienset joined her like a bodyguard. Miller remained seated, maintaining silence. Edgar and I surveyed the scene with apprehension. We had all seen Reichel in this state before and could only watch him with anxiety. He was strong as a bull and couldn't be contained when he thus ran amok. Certainly not by a couple of weak neurotics like Edgar and myself. Nobody said a word to him, which seemed to enrage him a little more. He was striding up and down the place, lowering his head like a bull, ready to charge. I will demolish everything, tout, he suddenly exclaimed, and seized a half-empty bottle at the table and smashed it against the wall, missing by a matter of inches one of his own paintings. Alles will ich demolieren, tout le goddamn bazaar, he shouted wildly. With these words, he proceeded in earnest with his work of demolition, picking up glasses and plates with two hands and flinging them about indiscriminately. Okay, Reichel, go ahead, smash up the joint, smash up everything, that's going to make you feel good. Henry warmly encouraged him in the tone of a missionary priest giving a savage advance absolution for his misdeeds. Don't let anybody stop you. Here, what about this painting? Don't you think you ought to put your fist through it, tear it to bits, spit on it, trample on it? Du Hund, Reichel bellowed a wild look in his eyes. Wait till I get my hands around your throat. He chased him around the table, but Henry nimbly avoided the madman's fist and always ducked in time when a glass or a knife came flying in his direction. In the space of a few minutes, the place resembled a smashed-up saloon in a Western picture. Sure, I'm a Hund, Miller bellowed back at him from a safe distance, like a psychiatrist humoring a patient, but you're not doing your job properly, Reichel. It's not good enough to smash the furniture to smithereens. I want to see you destroy this picture here, your own, the one with the drunken leer in its cosmological eye. Do it, I dare you. Use the fork, or shall I get you the carving knife from the kitchen? It must have been Henry's tutelary angel which prompted him thus. It was the only way to bring Reichel to his senses. Not instantly, of course. Blind with rage, he stumbled to the painting. Miller was pointing at one of those watercolors specially painted for Betty, and raising the fork he was holding was on the point of slashing it. For a fraction of a second, the fork remained suspended in the air, and then a look of utter grief came over him. He flung the fork away. Not even in a drunken stupor could he destroy what he had created with love. A raucous cry issued from his throat, and when a moment later he collapsed on the floor, shaken with sobs. The crisis had reached its climax. He could now be left to himself. In a minute or two, Reichel would be fast asleep, his angel gently bawling him out. It was always like that. Betty knew it. We all knew it. He spoiled every party. He couldn't help it. It wasn't really his fault, but his demons. And since the demon, as well as the angel, formed an integral part of him, it was no use ostracizing either of them. The two were constantly fighting it out at him, ferociously, like a couple of gangsters. The angel usually won in the end, but only in the end. Reichel looked a bit pale and subdued when he arrived at the Villa Surratt the next morning. He apparently had no conscious recollection of his misbehavior. At any rate, he never apologized. To apologize for the outrage would have been tantamount to recognizing it, ratifying it in cold blood, as it were, and the angel would never have stood for that. He usually came with a small gift on such occasion, a watercolor for Betty and a bunch of flowers for Miller, or vice versa, and he never stayed long, just long enough to make sure there were no ill feelings. If offered a glass of wine, he would resolutely refuse it.
If I have to die, which I imagine I will, I don't imagine it, I just know I'm going to have to. I want to die like my father. My father died fucking. He did, man. He was 57. Woman was 18. He came and went at the same time. Did nobody cry at his funeral? Everybody said, lucky motherfucker. And nobody else would fuck the woman for 2 years either.
And no, I don't want none of that pussy. Thank you. No. No.
No.
And you know, I noticed that there's a difference in funerals. Like, white people have funerals. They love their dearly departed, but their funerals be different. They don't give it up easy. You know, they hold their shit in until they get home. Maybe they go, they faint. They get at a funeral. Black people let it hang out right off. Then they fall on your ass. They don't never faint, they just lean on your ass. You got to carry them to the car and just say, bitch, get up. Damn. You got to kill me because that motherfucker dead. My grandmother could yell like that, scare the shit out of you at a funeral, right? My father, she said, wow, chicken, that mess of shit, what's the matter, mama? I thought maybe he raised up or something, you know? She did that voice, made me stop snorting cocaine. She pulled that shit on me. She said, what's that you doing, boy? I said, cocaine, mama. She said, whoa, Jesus, happy, go kill that guy, go kill me, go kill that guy, go kill that guy. I said, mama, don't do that shit. Look, I'm slowing it up. Look, mama, I'm putting it down in the toilet. $1,600 worth of shit. She found out how much it cost. She got mad. You dumb motherfucker. You could have sold some of that shit back to the man you got it from. Told you that shit make you ignorant. Goddamn. Ain't got sense enough to pull piss out of boot with a directions on a bottle. She says shit like that before she beat my ass.
In this scene, the genie is back in the bottle. The east side of New York, Hester Street. The back of an old Jewish candy store. The old man is cleaning up the store. And... Shane wird der Levuna, lechzig wird der Stere, von Himmel am Etone, hast du mit sie geschickt. Mein Glück, I never saw this bottle before. This day is a cockroach in that thing, though. They'll tell us that in the bottle.
Who are you?
I am the genie.
You come from this neighborhood.
No, old man, you've let me out of my glass prison at Sabun Prison, Vian. Oh, wondrous old man, a wondrous wish, and it's yours. Quickly, give me a wish, old man.
Well, I wish I had some income property.
It's yours.
And the room filled up with 15 beautiful girls.
Old man, another wish.
Well, I'd like to go to Atlantic City.
Go! Who'll take care of the store?
I will.
You can take care of the store. I'm the genie. I can do anything.
All right, I'll go. But don't give no credit to the Schwartzes.
He goes. The genie takes wonderful care of the store. He brings in the milk and the rolls and the bananas and the guess what's and the Mary Janes and the whole... And the old people start to file in the morning. They look up. Where's Saul?
He went to Atlantic City.
You're taking care of the store?
Yes.
You can take care of a candy store.
I'm the genie. I can do anything.
All right, all right. Make me a malted.
You're a malted.
Of course, my friend Perlis. From his book, my friend Henry Miller. This one is called Le Faisan de l'Histoire. It's a little article by Betty Ryan. It was a great day in the Velocirat when Larry Durrell at last came up from Corfu. Henry Miller was there to receive him, full of eagerness and curiosity, I suppose after their long and ardent exchange of letters. Anybody who knew Miller had heard about the gifted young Durrell who arrived in Paris with his Nancy, his golden youthfulness, his golden speech, and his robust winning laughter. One Sunday in early October of 1937, an unusually warm Sunday for those years, A few of the most frequent visitors to number 18 in the Villa Sarad gathered in my studio, ground floor right, for a luncheon to welcome the Durrells. Present were Henry Miller, Fred Perlis, Hans Reichel, the painter and poet, Larry and Nancy Durrell, and myself. Mr. Tichow, our Chinese friend, stopped in late for coffee. The windows of the big studio were open front and back, onto the cobbled street and onto a diminutive courtyard with a green. A friendly Indian summer light filled the high-ceilinged space. There was a sense of excitement in the air, a sense of the gala occasion that it was. Conversation and the good wine flowed. Nobody held back. Durrell was at ease, vocal, full of jokes, full of seriousness. Late toward the end of the day, Henry Miller, all at once, rose from his chair, commanded our attention, and with a wry, conspiratorial smile said, "You know, we around this table are making history. I know it may sound crazy, but history it is." He wagged his head and hummed, and then burst into laughter, holding his glass high. While at lunch, amiable Larry Durrell, with his strong voice and rich, almost unctuous words, had evoked for us the immensity of the sky that is like the emblem of Greece, the blinding curtain of light at noon, the dramatic line of the Albanian mountains across from the north, from his north, Corfu village. We followed him as he plunged into the shining water of the tiny bay before his house and miraculously caught a fish with his hands. Durrell in letters had been urging Miller to visit him on Corfu. Durrell was still trying to lure him with his Ionian landscape and tall Attic tales. Henry Miller, always attracted by stories from far away exotic places, attentively followed Larry's words with a subliminal hum of approval. Miller would nod his head now and again as though to spur Larry on to even greater transports of vision and language. Miller liked to egg people on to their utmost. Miller's own talk, like his presence, was elastic and mercurial. He would strike out into metaphysics, often without preamble, with the same admixture of erudite words and Brooklynese slang that he used when discussing everyday matters like the agonizing problem of heat at number 18. Often he strode about as he talked, modulating his voice from low to high, to a high, almost squeaky pitch. He and Hans Reichel had been speaking of Knut Hamsun's Mysteries, a great favorite with both. Miller and Reichel were never long together before some mention was made of Nagel, Hamsun's enigmatic hero. Each carried within himself an aspect of Nagel, but aspects that were widely different, for no two men were more unlike than Reichel and Miller. Their bond was admiration, sometimes spiced by jealousy. An exquisite Reichel watercolor hung on the wall near our table, and Miller had stepped over to examine it and was rhapsodizing over it. Suddenly he turned to Reichel and asked him if he would destroy the picture for the sake of love for a woman. Reichel anguished. Miller pressed him as though with a desire to expose Reichel's very quick, his demon. Reichel, almost in tears, his back against the wall, said he would not destroy the painting. Miller, with his attractive style and talk, could also be a good listener. He listened with his inner ear. If a man had anything to say, Miller could hear it. He listened to Durrell, and he listened to Reichel. Reichel had been saying that Larry Durrell was an old soul, that is, not a neophyte in the matter of being a Geistern de Seel, or a Gastersoul in Reichelian English. A high compliment from Reichel. One had to listen very carefully when Reichel spoke, for there were silent intervals between his words. He spoke in images without exposition. He gave the elements of the chain. It was up to the listener to link them together. He would let single words drop with the weight of a heavy stone, a heavy lodestone that might splinter into 100 prophetic parts. Miller used to say that when Reichel entered a room with his outlandish, gigantic stride, it was like explosive matter entering, for Reichel trailed in with him his baggage of the sublime, of melancholia, mysteries, chimeras. In Fred's bag these days was his new acquisition of an ungainly little mag with a droll, permanently attached name of The Booster. This was cause for fanciful flights of glory and hilarity. The inelegance and whimsicality of the enterprise caused Anais Nin disdainfully to dub it a childish prank. Even so, boosting the booster as bottles of Medoc emptied themselves, emptied and made for lively sallies around the table. Each one boosted the next, themselves, their friends, dogs, cats, and chattel, a grand spoof. When Mr. Tichow ceremoniously joined us, he was also prevailed upon to join the boosters, in Chinese if he wished. The convolutions of talk over the hours also had lingered over the diary of Nijinsky, lauded the philosophy of Lao Tzu, touched on Krishnamurti and Madame Blavatsky, a favorite of Miller's. Dark had fallen, the lamps had been turned on. It was then that Miller arose to make his toast to his fellow Gastersouls. C'est une faisoine de l'histoire.
poetry and jazz.
Psychopathia sexualis. I'm in love with a horse that comes from Dallas. Poor neurotica me. When my family found out, they raised the roof, 'cause I bought a ring to fit her hoof. Poor brain, the size of a pea. She looks so nice against the rail, with her pretty long legs and her ponytail. I guess against convention I'll never win. I'll probably end up in the loony bin, but in my heart I'll always be free. The head shrinker said my societal concept had been warped by an Oedipus Rex, which caused me to hate the opposite sex. But what he doesn't know is that my second wife was a 10-pound goose named Dex. I'm paranoid and sublimated, in love with a horse that ain't been spaded. Traumatic scene, please let me be. I've been hypnotized, tranquilized, analyzed, rationalized, taking every pill from Seconal to Dexamil. Sitting with my wife, necking in the dark, and knowing her ex-lovers are running at Hollywood Park. Can be a bug, I will admit, but it's all made up when I see her running around the house in a negligee, brace and bit. Like most young couples, we had our fights, deciding what's fair about her rights. We finally got adjusted, and I was boss, when I woke one morning, and on a lawn I found a fiery cross. The Ku Klux Klan said we had to get out that day. Move everything, lock, stock, horse, and carriage. The Klan wouldn't stand for no mixed marriage, so I'm feeling blue. Ain't got a penny in my pocket. We're gonna volunteer for a satellite rocket, so me and her can sit and spoon and visit my first wife who jumped over the moon. Poetry and all that jazz.